When I almost didn't make it, my brain and heart finally came together and said, "Kid, you need to stop being so angry at the world. These are the cards you have been dealt, so work with them."
Welcome to the Telling It Our Way podcast. I'm Becca.
And I'm Jill Rita.
In this podcast, we bring you stories by disabled people about disabled people. Stories from the daily lives of self-advocates with intellectual and developmental disabilities.
We are disabled people with complicated lives. We do not want your pity, and we are not here to inspire you.
That's right. This is not inspiration porn. Hello, everyone. Welcome, welcome. You may have heard in that introduction that Allie is not with us today, but instead we have a very special guest host, our advisory board member, Jo Rita Fox. Jo Rita, will you introduce yourself to our audience?
Hello, I'm Jo Rita Fox, and I've been a self-advocate since about 1999 when People First of Toledo was first founded. I'm secretary of both People First and Salute, which are two local self-advocacy groups, and I'm also president of the ARC of Ohio.
Jo Rita, we are so excited to have you on the podcast. You may remember that you've heard from Jo Rita before. She's shared stories in the past, but I'm really excited to just chat with you today a little bit. You are this huge figure in the self-advocacy movement here in Northwest Ohio. Can you talk to us a little bit more about how you came into that?
Well, when I moved to Toledo, I came up for a job. The people, or the school that I was employed at, they knew about my disability when they hired me. But then as the school year went on, they fired me because of it. And I just morphed from my working to support groups to volunteering. And then after I volunteered for 25 years and had to get my elbow replaced, I didn't want to go back to volunteering again. So I got into the self-advocacy movement.
I mean, I think that story resonates so well with our topic today. So today we're talking about confidence. And we have two stories here of people who I think have some similar experiences to yours, where they've had something that kind of knocked back their confidence and then are going to tell us about how they found it again. But before we jump into those stories, I want to hear a little bit more from you, Jo Rita. What makes you feel confident?
Well, I feel the most confident when I'm doing something that I enjoy, that I'm good at. And if I have to pick one particular activity, it would probably be writing the minutes for my People First and Salute meetings, because I really enjoy doing that. It's a lot of responsibility. I have to take good notes. And sometimes I have to go back and look at the presentations from that month, what we talked about. But I always manage to get them done. And it makes me feel real good when I do.
Yeah. And because I know you, Jo Rita, I also know that it's important for you to be of service to people. And is that something that gives you confidence too?
Oh, yes. When I moved into Astor House in March of 21, I was working with two broken femurs, and I was very, very sore. And I was scared to death that I would be seen as irrelevant, you know, that I wouldn't be able to do the activities and the jobs that I've been used to doing, but that hasn't happened.
Yeah, right.
As I stated earlier, I'm president of the ARC of Ohio, and we just had our national convention in Columbus, And I even introduced the governor.
I would say, Jerita, you are the farthest thing from irrelevant. But I think that's such a good point, right, that we get confidence from making contributions. And so I did a little bit of research around confidence and intellectual and developmental disability. And it seems like, in general, the research says that people with IDD experience lower self-esteem than their non-disabled counterparts. A study from 2012 from Patterson and colleagues found that this is usually linked to when people experience stigma, right? Which makes sense. If somebody has a low opinion of you, you start to internalize that and have a low opinion of yourself. And I think we talk a lot on this show about how there are often these really low expectations for people with disabilities. And when you don't give people, when you don't think that someone can succeed, you don't give them an opportunity to try. And of course, that leads to this low self-confidence. And so I wonder, does that impact any of your thinking around confidence, especially thinking about how committed you are to the self-advocacy movement?
Well, when I was a young girl, and I was born back in 1954, there was a lot of stigma about people with disabilities. We were treated as second-class citizens. I had lots of problems with, and I even had issues with my own family. But as I got older, I realized that God had given me talents and abilities that I was still discovering. Through that, I got into the advocacy movement, and that has empowered me to fight for the things that I feel are important.
Yeah, so I found this other study from 2022 with Jung and colleagues that said pretty much what you're saying, right? So the more that people with disabilities accept their disability, accept their talents, accept their uniqueness, and are not made to feel ashamed about that, the more likely they are to have a higher self-esteem, to have more confidence. And that sounds exactly like what that process of discovery was like for you. So yeah, I mean, I think that resonates really nicely. But now I think I'd like to hear a story. So we're going to turn it over to Ellison. And Ellison is going to share a story about how an experience with a catastrophic illness really transformed how she thought about herself and the people around her. So let's listen.
My name is Ellison Weber, and I was born in 1977, 4 weeks early. I didn't have the ability to suckle and had low muscle tone. I want to tell you how I learned to accept the cards I was dealt. Thirteen years ago, I got very sick. It began with a horrific headache and strange seizures at work. I was transported to St. V's ER. My anti-seizure medication, Topamax, was increased, and I was sent to my parents' house so I wouldn't be alone in case the medication change didn't help. The next morning, Mom woke me up. I went to take a step, and I collapsed. I was completely paralyzed on my left side, and I'm a lefty. I was transported to UTMC's ER. When I was being transported, I remember the technician teasing me and saying, "Will you quit seizing? You're making my heart monitor go crazy." I was completely aware when a seizure would begin because I could still talk, even though my arm and leg would begin to shake. We thought I wasn't going to make it because my neurologist couldn't figure out what was wrong, and after 4 days in the hospital under observation, a psychiatrist who visited me for 10 minutes diagnosed me as having conversion disorder, which meant I was causing my own seizures. He was ready to release me to my parents, but they decided they could not care for me at home. They made arrangements for me to be transferred to the Arbors in Oregon, an inpatient rehab facility. I was there for about 36 hours, during which time I became even more ill. My memories from being at the Arbors are: 1, my left ankle being sprained as they transferred me from a wheelchair to a chair in my room, 2 blueberry pancakes the next morning, 3 our cousin Stephen, who's a lawyer, coming and having me sign paperwork saying my parents could make decisions for me. I couldn't even sign my name. I can only make half an X. And 4 falling out of bed because I couldn't reach the call button and my I have courage plaque being broken. I was seizing so horrifically to the point it was every 7 minutes. I kept getting sicker. From what my parents told me, because I don't remember any of this, my mom, who's my biggest advocate, said the head nurse had called and said, I don't understand why Ellison is here, and my mom telling her, we don't know why she's there either. Then the day nurse called and said, I can't get Ellison to swallow her meds. She spiked a fever. She's turning bright red and is gasping for air. Mom then said, we're on the way. And for the day nurse to call the head nurse. The head nurse then called EMS. I was transported to St. Charles, which was across the parking lot from rehab, but it took EMS over an hour to stabilize me so I could be moved. At that point, I was in critical condition. They eventually performed a lumbar tap and diagnosed me with meningitis and encephalitis. I was then transferred back to UTMC, where I was admitted to the ICU in critical condition. Let me tell you a little bit more about myself. I have an associate's degree in office administration technology from Owens Community College and was living on my own, working and driving my own car before all of this happened. I was blessed with a wonderful memory and was actively involved with the Village Players Theater. I would help with props and was the data entry demon for the season subscription database since I can type over 50 words per minute. Often, my dad was on stage and I'd help him rehearse lines. It got to the point where one of the running jokes at rehearsal was, we don't need a book holder, we have Ellison. I had the script memorized and knew everybody's parts. I can also name that tune in a few lyrics or from first lines of songs. I was in the ICU in critical care for 4 days until I was transferred to the neuro unit where I had originally spent 4 days. I then moved to inpatient rehab for an additional 10 days where I participated in both physical therapy and occupational therapy. Just getting showered, dressed, and eating were challenges and became therapy. One of the only things I remember was my parents brought my fur child Annabelle up for a couple of visits. I was absolutely overjoyed because music and puppies make me happiest. After a full month, I came home using an old-time walker complete with sweaty balls. Over the next year, I went through physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy, and finally learned how to drive again, all thanks to the helpful folks at UTMC. I couldn't do anything, and it was extremely frustrating because I'd gone from being completely independent to having to depend on everybody. I had lost my long-term memory, I couldn't remember growing up, and it was very frightening and frustrating. Before I got sick, I was stuck in an angry stage, constantly questioning, why me? Why am I so different from my parents and family? It took many years for me to get services from the Board of DD. From 1977 to 2012, I had no services. My parents and Nana, Grandma, may she rest in peace, had to support me with everything. I actually just started getting DD services before I got sick. It took proving that I had a genetic condition, which we lovingly refer to as Ellison syndrome, because I have an extra piece of genetic material at this exact same chromosome that Cornelia DeLange has the deleted piece of genetic material, making both of us different not less. I'm proud to say I was the first person in the USA diagnosed with this condition. I was feeling completely lost and helpless. My parents and I were worried I'd never go back to living in my own place and being completely independent. I had blood work done because I was going to see my neurologist the next day. That evening, she called to ask if I had taken my anti-seizure medication. The answer was, not yet. She said, don't take it because the lab work said it's becoming toxic. My medications were changed and rebalanced, which caused the cloud to be lifted. My memory was returning. When I finally got to work with the occupational therapist who had to clear me to drive again, I remember saying, I know where I am now. Our cousins live over there. We live over here. I would literally squeal with joy that my memories were slowly but surely starting to come back. In the past, I was always being the Debbie Downer, thinking, why did I have to be born this way? Why me? Why me? Why me? When I almost didn't make it, my brain and heart finally came together and said, kid, you need to stop being so angry at the world. These are the cards you have been dealt, so work with them. I met a lot of other people with disabilities at Harbor, iDance, and one of my best friends, Melissa, who's no longer with us, who was born with spinal bifida in a wheelchair. However, that didn't stop her from being the best person she could be and would often say to me, if I get mad enough, I'll roll over your tootsies. And I saw how she and other people who didn't have as much support as both of us did, learning to deal with the ups and downs in life. I also realized that my parents weren't the enemy. They've been my lifelong advocates, and thanks to joining Salute, I'm learning to be an advocate for myself. As my sass Michelle said at one point, quote, moms and dads don't lie about anything. Thank you for listening.
So I think there's so much to take from Ellison's story here, talking about the way that she kind of really changed how she thought about herself, right? This was really, you know, there's the physical changes that she went through experiencing this illness, but really it was this turn where she stopped being, she talks about being angry with the world as a person with a disability and about how this experience kind of changed that for her. And she started to think more positively about herself and the people around her. But what did you think about the story, Jorita?
Well, I thought it was a very good story. And I think it took a lot of courage on Ellison's part to tell it. I know she was very angry at times. And I can relate to that because I felt I was always trying to prove myself. Mm. And there was one point in time where when I was volunteering at what was then MCO, I was encouraged to go for a part-time patient information position. And I applied for it and passed the civil service test. But I found out that I would have lost all my benefits. Mm. And this was many years ago. This was when things were a lot different than they are now. But I threw darts at the walls for some time. And then I realized that when you throw darts, the only thing you get are holes in the wall.
Yeah.
So I began to realize that, hey, I may not be getting a paycheck for what I was doing, but nobody could ever convince me that volunteering wasn't just as important, wasn't considered work. Mm-hmm. Like the guy sitting next to me that was getting paid.
Yeah. And for our audience, maybe go back and listen to our episode on benefits where we talk about some of these issues like the ones that you came up against, Jorita. But yeah, I love that, that way that you're shifting your perspective there. So how about another story?
Okay.
So this time we're going to hear from Heidi. And Heidi, who's going to share, after she had some kind of bad experiences with employment in the past, she's going to share how her current workplace empowers her to work independently.
I had my first stroke back in 2003. After my first stroke, I was having trouble with my speech. Once I got out the sentence, I'm good. But starting out, it's hard. Sometimes I know that people try to help me out with my thoughts. That's the worst. Like sometimes having a hard time figuring out what I want to say quickly. I don't say it quickly, they will try to help me out. So Mom encouraged me to do things through my music. So then I started writing music. I haven't gotten anything recorded, and I really want to do that just because finding somebody that will do that, it's hard. The last song I wrote was about going to the Cleveland Clinic and getting a second chance and working hard at keeping an open mind on things. Music wasn't a thing before my stroke. Now they say that writing music is stimulating, and I'm like, yeah, find me a recording studio. Back in 2020, during the COVID-19, I had another acute stroke. That was very difficult. I went through several months of rehab. My mom said that I didn't remember anybody at all after that stroke. I had to totally learn how to read and write. Before my stroke, I think I worked at a grocery store until they closed. I had a hip replacement, which was a hot mess. But the doctor originally did my surgery, but he put the screws in backward. I went to work for a restaurant for about a year. Then I got completely by myself because the job coach was on vacation. General manager happened to call me and wanted to have a chat, so she asked me if I wanted to come in and talk to her right then and there. I got hired. I lost my position because they couldn't find more for me to do. They didn't want to pay for somebody to do my job. That's when they started to cut back my hours, and it wasn't just me, it was a number of people that got their hours chopped. So then I was out of work for roughly about 2 months. I got hired in an Italian market, and I've been there for almost a year now, working with coworkers. Anything I can't do, they're willing to help. The boss is phenomenal. Anything I need to do as far as anything, he kind of helps out with that. They usually try to make up a list for me that will help me through my shift. Can just go back in the office and say, okay, what do you want me to do? I'm not afraid to go up to the general manager. I'm not afraid to ask one of the assistants or anybody, hey, what do you want me to do? I think it's important that people know that people can do things with disabilities, can do know that without supervision.
All right. right. So this was Heidi's story. And again, I think there's like so much here that we could unpack about kind of these low expectations that she experienced at one workplace, and then the way that having the people around you believe in you can really change your own mindset too. What did you think about Heidi's story, Jorita?
Oh, I thought it was very, very good. And it showed how someone could go through negative experiences and really have a lot of issues in the employment world and still come out on top.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
You have to, as I say in some of my speeches and stories, you have to keep on keeping on.
Yeah, right. There's a lot about resilience here.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And I think actually our next episode is going to be dedicated to employment. So we're going to talk a little bit more about some of these issues soon. But I wanted to just talk a little bit about how there's a lot of research that talks about how work and paid work specifically is a really huge factor for a lot of people with disabilities in terms of how they perceive themselves, right? And in terms of self-esteem and self-confidence. And we know that that's true, but the employment rate is really bad for people with developmental disabilities. The National Core Indicator says only 15% of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities have paid work in their communities.
I think that probably goes back to employers being leery of people with disability and whether or not they can do the job, how much it will cost to give them accommodations.
Yeah, all that stigma and stereotypes. And like we talked about at the beginning, when people are fed this stigma, it impacts how they see themselves. And it's just this vicious cycle, right? And we can make that into a better cycle, right? If we believe in people, if we commit to this idea that people are competent and people are able to do the things that they set their minds to, then that creates a different set of circumstances, right?
Yes. You have to believe in yourself, and you have to have the courage to go after whatever it is that you want and stick to it. You might not achieve it the first time or even the second time, but get up and dust yourself off and try it the third time. The third time might be the charm.
And that is a great place for us to land this episode. So, Jorita, is there anything else you want to say before we go?
Well, I just thank you for inviting me. And I hope that we have educated our listeners and given them something to think about.
I think we definitely have, and you're welcome back anytime, Jorita. So before we end, I want to thank our contributors, Ellison and Heidi, our associate producer, Connor Smenner, our intern, Ava Gottschalk, and our Telling It Our Way advisory board members, Jorita Fox, Quinn Thomas, and Gavin Daly. And special thanks to WGTE and our producer, Chris Pfeiffer. To access transcripts for this show and any other show notes, please visit wgte.org/ourway.
I'm Jorita Fox.
And I'm Becca Monteleone, and you've been listening to Telling It Our Way.
WGTE. Voices around us.
WGTE is supported in part by the American Rescue Plan Act funds, allocated by the City of Toledo and the Lucas County Commissioners, and administered by the Arts Commission.